Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 56, and this is recorded on February 7th of 2019. I'm here with, I'm going to call him a friend. You know, we haven't really met in person, I don't believe.
Oh, yes, we have.
Oh, yes, we did. We met at the NECCC conference.
That is correct, yes.
That's right. Yes. This is Shiv Verma here with me. And Shiv, you know, I don't know much about you personally. I know that you've got kids and grandkids, and you are a Lumix professional. You've got an affinity for fountain pens, and I don't know what else there is to say from my knowledge. But if you could give people the elevator pitch as to who you are and where your passions lie photographically, we can get the conversation started.
Super, super. Well, as far as my own passions, they're too varied to cover in a single podcast. But primarily, I mean, I love photography, and I've been doing photography ever since I was a teenager when I got my first camera. And you know, the whole sort of movement from film to different kinds of film, from 35 millimeters to 120mm, and then a little bit of the large format. I mean, so it's all been a transition which I've thoroughly enjoyed.
It's a journey, right?
It's absolutely a journey. And then you go through your schooling, you go through university, and then the pressure starts as to you got to start working. And I was fortunate enough to join IBM, which put me into the frame of mind of being kind of geeky, and hence this podcast is so ideally suited.
Sorry, it took me so long to get you on as a guest.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, 56 episodes, that's fantastic. I mean, so congratulations on that. You crossed the 1 year mark, which is a great thing.
A lot of
podcasts start, and then by the 15th podcast, the person's either run out of topics or doesn't know what to do, and then the podcast just disappears.
Thankfully, we have the ability to just pick through the news from the week and use that as the basis for a conversation. And there's always going to be geeky things to talk about photographically.
It's
going to be a continuous, constant stream. And some weeks I basically have to say, okay, well, there's 10 stories we can talk about. Let's save some for later, or just figure out what's going to be the best connection here. Yeah.
The likelihood of a later story never happens, because the next week there's something else.
Exactly. So some things you just miss out on. But we've got a lot to talk about today. And you mentioned, your transition from film photography in various formats through to digital photography, and to some degree from amateur to professional as well, as most photographers will evolve. Mm-hmm. You're also a Panasonic ambassador, as am I. And so we both made that transition. And how would you feel, Shiv, if you took a great photograph and you were proud of it, maybe even printed it on your wall, and then you found an identical image submitted to a contest by somebody else who won something in that contest using not a similar photograph to yours, but exactly your image? What would that feel like?
Oh, I'd go ballistic. I'd absolutely go ballistic. I mean, we've had issues like, theft of artwork and theft of other people, or let's call it plagiarism. But plagiarism has many flavors. I mean, there's, you can copy an idea, you can copy a concept, you can try and replicate what the other artist has done. But I think where I would draw the line, and hence the term ballistic, is when there's absolutely no effort at all except to take the image and do something to it and call it your own. And the doing something to it is really nothing, maybe just a very slight tweak on exposure or a slight tweak on contrast. But fundamentally, the image is exactly the same. And that to me is nothing more than pure theft.
Yeah. And, I've taught people the techniques to do pretty much every type of imagery that I have published. I write about it at length with every time I publish an image. I wrote a book on how to photograph snowflakes, which is now out of print. I sold in the last week my final copies of it. So the 3,000 production run for that is done. You can still get the ebook if anybody's interested at skycrystals.ca. But that's an aside. The point is that in that book, there was a full tutorial that showed people every single step every single technique, gear, photographic workflow, and everything else. And people have replicated my image style and then started tweaking it to be their own. They're never going to take my images from me because, well, you know, every snowflake is unique. But when I teach water droplet refraction workshops and everybody can get similar images, I'm teaching them the same techniques, but it's always theirs, right? So the first story here is from Petapixel, titled "Man Can't Explain Why Prize-Winning Photo is Identical to Another Photographer's." And I'll just read the intro here because it kind of sets the stage. In September of 2018, the Chinese smartphone maker OnePlus announced the winners of a hashtag shot on OnePlus photo contest in India to celebrate the best photos captured on its phone cameras. One of the winning shots was a shock to photographer Aman Bhargava, who looked strangely, it looked strangely similar to a photo that he had captured two years earlier on his Canon DSLR. The submitted photo was by Pratyush Yadav. The photo looked like a slightly cropped version of the one that Bhargava captured in 2016 and posted on Instagram May 22nd of the following year, 2017. And this is an architecture photo. I encourage people to check out the show notes at photogeekweekly.com, where you can see the links and pull this up for yourself and take a look and make the comparison for yourself to judge. With architecture photography, Shiv, I'm sure you're familiar that a slight change in focal length, a slight change in height of the camera, or angling it a few degrees higher and lower is going to drastically change every single one of the lines. If you've got sunbeams coming into the photograph, taking the image a minute later or a minute earlier, those lines are not going to match up at all. There is 100% perfect alignment, like those children's books where you would say, you know, well, what's different from one image to the other, and you'd have to pick out, you know, this person's not wearing a shoe or so and so. I've got a 2.5-year-old daughter, so we're playing with those right now. It's fresh in my mind. There's none of that here. It is pixel perfect, identical, and that's just straight out theft, as you had mentioned. But what really boils me is what happened next. Did you read the rest of the article?
Yes, I did. And let me just preface this, my statement, with something. The place where that image was taken is in a back then relatively small town when I was in school in Dehradun. And Dehradun is where we have a public school, as we call it in India, which is like a private school here, called the Dune School. And one of our field trips when I was probably about 11 or 12 years old, and I'll never forget it, was to this particular research institute. And we walked down that corridor, and I was actually at that point, you know, kicking myself for not having brought my camera, because this was a really very nice scene and perfect because of the way the light and shadows interplay between those pillars and things like that. So when I saw this image, it just took me back years ago to, I wish I had shot it. But, you know, fortunately, you know, the person who actually captured this image got it in good light, got, you know, some, you know, beautiful shadows. And then you start comparing the cropped version to the original version. And I like the way the article does an overlay to show how perfectly aligned both images are. But I actually blame, to some extent, also blame the competition chairs, if you want to call them that, for not picking up on some very basic elements. I mean, first and foremost, somebody's complaining to you that the image is not real. You know, at least do a small investigation. Just do an overlay and see, is the guy telling the truth or not?
Yeah.
And then this person has the audacity to send in the EXIF information and pick up on the fact that the EXIF information details the fact that the image was captured before the camera was made.
Yes, and at a different time than the original capture as well, because he faked the EXIF data to read 2 p.m. Well, there's no possible way you could have got that shadow structure at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's just not going to happen. Now, it's easy to fake EXIF data. All you need is a free copy of EXIF tool.
Yeah.
A wonderful tool from Phil Harvey. I don't know if there's there's probably a graphic user interface to it, but I know the command line stuff to just copy EXIF data from one file to another, and you can start overriding individual
values. Right, but the fact, that's not the issue. The issue really, I mean, I hate to interject you like this, but the issue really is not the fact that he changed the EXIF data, is that he didn't even so much in try and prove that the image was his. Yeah. I mean, presenting EXIF data is not coming back and saying, no, this is my image. Here's my raw file, all right? And present the raw file. The EXIF data in a raw file will really show you. And, oh, by the way, even if you do modify the EXIF data, I'm sure that whoever writes software will put in a few little triggers that will tell you when the EXIF data was modified.
Well, Canon and Nikon both had that feature a while ago. This was in their earlier cameras, and they had, I remember, some image verification kit that you could buy for their professional cameras. And that was sort of having those little triggers in there. I'm not sure exactly what secret sauce they were doing, but it was that technology. It was hacked, as most things are. And so the validity of that content can no longer be confirmed based on those methods. But it doesn't seem like this photo thief would have necessarily had that skill set anyhow. It just seems like somebody wanted to find a good image online, enter a photo contest, and get a free phone. So there was a bit of back and forth on this. But finally, the company OnePlus had stated an official announcement, and it read, we are of the honest opinion that the contest winner, and they give the Instagram handle, that lone traveler, of the World Photography Day contest may have indulged in malpractice. No, really? That may have potentially involved a violation of Mr. Aman Bhargava's intellectual property, and such acts, once proven, are a punishable offense under the law of the land. We are appalled that such an incident has happened and understand the ordeal you as an artist had to go through. We would like to state that we did all possible measures to ensure all terms and conditions for the contest were followed. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly for this case, it was mandatory for the photo to be shot on a OnePlus device. When we received all the photos and examined all their EXIF details, we found no discrepancies. Hence, all photos met the criteria, and we assure you that we have not been negligent in assessing the same. Well, if they only looked at the make and model of the camera, then they'd be telling the truth, because you can easily override the EXIF data. Mm-hmm. The fact that they missed out on the very obvious year marker,
right.
That tells me that they did not look hard enough. They were not very diligent in their efforts. And one simple thing, I mean, I'm not sure how many winners there are for this contest, but assuming there are not thousands of them, it's easy for you to take any submitted photograph and throw that into Google as a reverse image search and see where else it shows up online and if it shows up from any other photographer. And I think that for a photo contest to run successfully, that is a very small additional step for you to do. If it shows up under anybody else's name anywhere else online, it calls it into question and do a little bit more digging, ask some questions, and find the right answer.
Yeah, and Don, you know, you make a very good point. I mean, I, for years, actually, with the Photographic Society of America, initially I was basically responsible for all the nature competitions, the international, as we called it. And then finally, I was responsible for all the divisions. So it included pictorial, it included 3D and nature and travel and photojournalism, etc. It's virtually impossible to go through thousands and thousands and thousands of images to validate them. But before you actually, you know, define an image to be eligible for a prize, no matter what that prize is, and that image which is going to then get published in some way as a winning image, if all you did was to validate those images, whether they were 5, 10, or 20.
Exactly my point. Yeah.
You can go ahead and do it. And when you do that, make sure that you're validating it in its entirety. You know, don't just look at, you know, what camera was it shot with or whatever. I mean, look at the rest of it. There are situations where, you know, we've found images to have been modified.
There are software tools out there that can very easily show you any issues where an image might have been composited from two separate photographs, or that can compare the underlying noise pattern and reveal areas that have been cloned or otherwise touched up.
Right.
So that software, if that was one of your criteria, saying no localized editing, yes, you can crop or you can adjust the contrast or brightness and that sort of stuff, and that's okay.
Remove dust spots.
No adding or removing things. Yeah. Then there are tools also to confirm the criteria involved there.
Absolutely. Now, the next thing that really comes up is, what's the value of the prize? Now, if it's like, you know, $50, $100, who really cares? Nobody does. But if it's of value, whether it be a phone or $500 or $1,000, again, you've got to look at, where is this prize being awarded? If you're awarding a prize of $50 to somebody in the US, it's no big deal. But you award a $50 prize to somebody in a poor country, it's a big deal.
Yeah, somebody in Bangladesh, I'm sure, would really enjoy a $50 prize.
So again, you know, those are things that we need to take into consideration. But irrespective, theft is theft.
Yeah. Now, what I think OnePlus should have done here is basically, the company has demanded the $600 smartphone pack back, and as they should. But they should give the original photographer, Aman Bhargava, a free phone. I mean, yeah, sure, his photo wasn't taken on this, but you need to make good on this. You can't just say, I'm sorry. Just send him a phone. You are a very large corporation. Make this guy happy. Make him shoot on your phone. Bring him into the fold on this one, I think.
But I think the other problem, Don, that we've not covered is giving this guy a phone, to me, may not be enough. Because think about it. You as a major corporation have used this image to further advertise your product. Maybe, and I don't know where all it may have been used, maybe it's been used to show how good the image capabilities of the phone are. And there is a lot of other dollar or other, let's say, monetary value that may have been derived from the use of that image.
So at the bare minimum, then at least find out how much value that image has in terms of any money made from it. Mm-hmm. Or check out Getty Images has a rights managed photo price calculator. And I'll try to dig that up and put a link to it in the show notes, because I use it when I'm trying to price out a license for clients. And it can be considered an industry standard, although a lot of bulk licensing prices are going to be much less than those numbers that are spit out. It gives you a starting point. And at the very least, wouldn't it be nice for OnePlus to plug in all of the variables, you know, the usage scope, the industry, you know, digital or print, and all of those variables within there? It's going to spit out a number for how much that license would cost as per Getty Images, and then pay the man that too. You're right to say that more than a phone is where things need to go.
And then if you really want to, you know, get permission to use the image, because maybe you've already put yourself into a position where the image may have been printed, published, whatever it is, you know, get the right to use it and pay the person accordingly. I think that would be the most appropriate reconciliation of the issue.
I agree. Now, photo contests in general, I'm on the fence about them. Oftentimes, I'll read the terms of service, and they're very draconian or very poorly written, and they take too many rights away from the photographer. I know one local company, and I'm not going to name names, but they held a photo contest for images taken around the city of Barrie, and their prize was a new camera. And so if you get hundreds of submissions, if you put in your terms and conditions that any image submitted, that company will have the rights to use in perpetuity for any purposes whatsoever, then all of a sudden, they have just, for the cost of a camera, gathered licenses for hundreds of local images, and they can use any of them for whatever purpose they want, even if they didn't win the contest. And so I've approached certain contests, and I've seen wording like this, and I say, you know what, you should really change the scope to say any honorable mention and winning photographs, you get the rights for. But anything that you do not recognize as worthy of recognition, then you have no rights to those images whatsoever.
Basically, you should release all rights to such images.
I mean, exactly. And that's the way these terms and conditions should be written. I've never seen one written that way. I've had a few changed to reflect that kind of narrative, but I've never seen it that way to begin with. So be wary of entering a photo contest. Yeah. But people that I've talked to, that I bring this up to, they change those rules if they are able to. And and they've been really receptive to saying, hey, you know what, if you could change this to this, it would be great. You don't lose anything. The photographers just gain. Yeah, it's a win-win scenario.
And again, it's also depending upon, who and what the organization is that is, conducting this competition or whatever. Right. I mean, we do it in the PSA and our thing, statement of intent is very, very clear. It's, yes, we can use the images. We'll publish it to recognize you. But we may also use the images for educational purposes. And that's the only time we'll use it. Nothing else. So
yeah, very fair. Okay, let's move on to the next story here. And this is from DP Review, although I've seen it reported many places, that Panasonic Lumix Pro Services is it's going to be a support program, and it's now currently accepting applications. So Pro service programs are not anything new. I was a member of Canon Professional Services for years, CPS, and NPS for Nikon users has been around, and there might be more. I haven't really kept tabs on what all of the various vendors have to offer their professionals. But this is great, especially because Panasonic has just, of course, announced the Lumix S1 and the S1R with a full spec sheet for people to enjoy, and cameras will be in hand within a few months. So, Shiv, as you're also a Panasonic ambassador here, this, to me, means that Panasonic is really standing behind their new full frame gear. But I'm seeing all of the gear listed, the G85, G9, G4, G5, G5S, and a ton of lenses, not just their Leica-branded lenses, but some of the lesser ones as well. They are all listed here as being eligible for participating within this program. And there's a lot of pros that are shooting Micro Four Thirds with Panasonic right now, you and me included.
So I think Panasonic was a little late in joining the pro services game. But what they have, in fact, published is exceptionally good. And it fits in with all the top-tier professional services offerings from Nikon, Sony, Canon, etc. And there are some defined, criteria for how you can join and what level you can get in at. And there is a monetary value to any such membership. But what I think more important, as far as I'm concerned, is that there was a little bit of a rumbling that, is Panasonic going to abandon the Micro Four Thirds world? Once you come out with full frame, is the Micro Four Thirds world going to be sort of subject to a slow, gradual demise? But I think the enforcement of a program like this is very clear that, they're not abandoning Four Thirds. They're actually putting a program together to further the use factors, the repairs, even the cleaning of these cameras. So professionals or non-professionals who have multiple products now have the ability to get the kind of service that they weren't being able to before.
Right. The cost, by the way, you mentioned, this is not a free service. It is $199 US, at least for the US. The terms and conditions and exact details might change from country to country. But I like the fact that it's an 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern accessibility window, where Canon, when they close the doors at 4:59, at 5 o'clock, you try to call somebody anywhere after that, you're just going to get an answering machine. Right. But the service turnaround of two business days, I mean, I don't know of anybody else that has that in terms of getting you back up and on your feet within 48 hours and free next day shipping. You get a discount on repairs of 20%, but even if you just...
Well, discount on non-warrantied products. I mean, if your warranty runs out, I mean, that's a big, big discount.
It is. Yeah. I mean, especially if it might be like, I remember I had, my Canon 15 millimeter fisheye lens, mm-hmm. and the aperture mechanism was starting to go on it. And Canon, luckily they had a spare part because it was an older lens. It was an f2.8 lens. They came out with an L zoom fisheye, but it was only f4. And I was using mm-hmm. it for astrophotography. That extra stop was important. And I really wanted this lens to be saved. Yeah. It cost me a lot to get that thing fixed. But what I like about this too is you get free sensor and electronic viewfinder cleaning and lens calibration on up to two bodies and two lenses per year, and you can ship it to them up to two times. So that's always been a for-pay service. Even like if I was a CPS member, unless I was going to an event that CPS was a part of, then they might offer that service as a compliment then, but not just in any old location. Definitely not lens calibration. They wouldn't touch that. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they're able to do all of this for the members, as a professional, $200 a year, especially, it's like an insurance policy for your equipment. And that seems very, very reasonable to me.
Well, if you think about it, Don, how much does a cleaning cost? If you were to take your camera to a cleaning company or even to a store, let's say you were not comfortable cleaning your own sensor.
I mean, I clean my own and I clean for others. Yeah. And I have a lot of people that come to me. And I shouldn't say a lot. I mean, it's not something that I advertise. If you're in my neighborhood, mm-hmm. then, you know, bring me your camera for $50. It doesn't take me long to clean it. But if you don't want to stick a wet swab inside of your camera touching the electronic components, if you're not comfortable with that, give it to me.
Yeah. So now you clean two cameras twice a year. Your membership's already paid for and the rest is all free.
Exactly. So
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it's really a very, very good deal. And I hope that, more companies put out, programs like this, because it's another level of competition that is good for the industry.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm glad that Panasonic is doing it. You're right that they've had professional gear for a long time and they mm-hmm. haven't had a professional service to their, pro photographers. Now they've got it. So better late than never. And I'm looking at the prices of 199 euro in Germany, 179 pounds sterling in the UK. And so the prices, and I'm sure some of the other mm-hmm. details will change, but that's right on par with what you might expect from any other large vendor. And it doesn't list it in these articles, but I mean, I've got to assume that it's going to end up covering the S-Series equipment as well.
Oh, I'm sure they will include that as soon as the S-Series is publicly available, which should be, early April, as far as I can see.
As far as we've been told, yeah.
The other thing that, and I'm not sure how many companies, Nikon, Canon, etc., do this, but if you're traveling, and let's say you're in Europe, you can avail of these services in the Panasonic counterpart in Europe.
I would hope so. It doesn't state anything about that here, but if they're just getting it rolling, I'm thinking that it's going to be compartmentalized at first. But if you mm-hmm. call Panasonic in one country and complain, I'm sure they'll ring up their counterpart in Germany and see if something could be done at the very least. Yeah. I'm sure that an effort would be made.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there we go. There's not too much to talk about on that story. It was just, hey, this is here now.
It's excellent that it is. I mean,
You need at least four qualifying lenses and at least two qualifying bodies. But, a lot of professionals
that's in the U.S.
have that kind of in the U.S. Yes. Requirements, again, as I said, would change based on region.
Right.
I'm not going to say it, but I see your pick of the week, or at least one of them, in this list of very high quality lenses. And so we'll get to that at the end of the episode.
I hope it never needs calibration.
I mean, I don't envy those people that have to calibrate a lens, because if I ever send them a lens that's out of calibration, it's because I have abused it so horribly. I have used it every single day and dropped it down a flight of concrete stairs, and now you have to deal with it.
Yeah, but fortunately, in the mirrorless world, Don, the need to calibrate lenses or to, let's say, micro adjust the focusing is not as imperative as it used to be.
Well, it used to be that the autofocus sensor was separate from the sensor. the main imaging sensor. And so if one was out of sync with the other, then the autofocus sensor would say, hey, you're perfectly where you want to be. But the image capturing sensor would reveal otherwise. But because most mirrorless cameras will have that much more integrated, then one equals the other in at least some cases. And I know that in the Lumix cases, that's true. So. Perfect. The next story is kind of an interesting kind of a throwback here. And I figured you might have some interest in this. The first story, and they're kind of tied together. They're both about Kodak. Kodak Film Business, this is from Petapixel, Kodak Film Business on the brink of being sold, says a report. So let's dial back to 2012 when Kodak filed for bankruptcy. And then Kodak continued to manufacture the paper and the emulsions, all the film, through Kodak Alaris. That was the company in charge of handling that. And, you know, they've just recently announced, we talked in the last episode, Ektachrome was going to be reintroduced, and they're bringing it into medium format and sheet film as well. So I was kind of shocked here. When an Inside Imaging report that they published about how Kodak Alaris is now shopping itself around, and it may be announcing the sale of its PFF, paper, photochemicals, and film unit, as soon as March of this year. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
Well, yeah, I've got to take that with a little bit of, say, a pinch of salt. When you say shopping around, there's multiple shopping around concepts out there. One of it could potentially be that they're looking for incremental funding to keep this thing really going. Because just having announced, you know, new products and just having stated that they will also manufacture, and you then say, all right, if the also term is being used, it means I need a little more money. And maybe the shopping around is not so much the sale of the business, but the acquisition of funds. So I'm hoping because of the way Kodak has been in the past and the fact that they weren't totally insolvent when they filed for bankruptcy. I mean, they were still there and they under bankruptcy protection. Yeah. And they restructured. And in some form, they've maintained a number of their businesses that were still viable. And I think film, to some extent, is still a viable business. And it has a unique popularity that's not going to die tomorrow.
Well, and especially if you consider the biggest consumers of film, it's not you and me, it's actually the motion picture industry. And there's a lot of demand for that production to continue on. And I'm sure that the motion picture industry would find some way for at least them to keep getting product, even if the consumer stills film were to disappear. And then third-party vendors, I'm sure, I mean, look at CineStill, what they do right now, is they take motion picture film and they rewrap it so that you can run it through your regular film still camera.
Right.
But this could tie into the announcement that was from a day or so earlier, or a week or so earlier, with Tetinol closing its doors, because a lot of the Kodak chemistry was at least partly manufactured by Tetinol. And it would seem difficult if the main supplier for certain chemicals disappears, they would have to find another supplier, or they would start having to manufacture some of those chemicals in-house. And if the infrastructure is not there anymore because their footprint is much smaller, then there would need to be a significant increase in funding to allow for at least that part of the business to continue. And it's difficult, I guess, for a manufacturer of film if you don't have the chemicals to process the film or to develop the paper to then offer these products and say, hey, you know, we've got half of the solution. You've got to go somewhere else for the rest.
Right. So that goes back to what I was saying earlier, is the funding to buy the chemicals business.
It could be.
So, you know, the fact that, I mean, where I get a little concerned is when people talk about timing. And, you know, to make an announcement that, you know, business is up for sale or potentially being sold or whatever it is, and then to put a timeline to say by March or in March, big companies don't get sold overnight. I mean, there's a lot of negotiation that has to happen. And maybe there are government approvals that are required for anything that potentially could pose another problem, since it already went bankrupt once.
Yeah, well, exactly. I'm sure there's a lot of hands in that cookie jar to figure out what goes where.
I'd be a little skeptical about a rumor mill like this. But again, who knows? Maybe the rumor mill knows better than you and I do.
Maybe. There has been the allure of film in many ways because it could do things or create a certain feel that the digital world just didn't have. It didn't have that same tactile experience that film shooters still very much enjoy, which leads me into a related story also found on Petapixel about a lens filter that faithfully recreates the look of Kodak Aerochrome infrared film. Mm-hmm. And if you've seen a Kodak Aerochrome image, you know it instinctively by looking at it because the foliage is vibrantly red instead of green. But much of the rest of the image still maintains a true to form kind of, your blue skies and a base tone that seems...
Albeit flatter.
But you've got these crazy crazy reds. This is a new filter that is produced by Coleri Vision. And I actually have some of their filters. I've got an ultraviolet filter that they gave me a while ago for testing. And then I ran out of time in the summertime to really put it to use. But that's sitting on my to-do list here. And they do some really interesting filters. They paired up with a French photographer, Jan Philippe, to produce this. And judging by the sample images that I've seen and the comparison, like right out of camera, looking at the back of the LCD screen, you've got this color effect, which I think is really useful because when I'm processing my infrared images for false color, there's channel swapping and lots of manipulation to get it to have the look that I want. So to have something that very faithfully recreates, they did a direct comparison actually of Aerochrome film and this new filter, and it's not exactly the same. I can chalk that up to the difference between digital and film in general, but it hits pretty much exactly the same wavelengths and the same response on the camera. And so Aerochrome has been out of production for a long time. You can buy a used roll of it, or not used, an expired used roll of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, used film is not too useful to the photographer, but expired film that can run you up to $80 a roll.
And you don't know if it's been in the fridge or not.
Exactly. And so to have a filter that can bring that feel, that look and feel to the digital era gives less and less of a reason for somebody to hunt down that old roll of film and run it through their camera. I'm not saying that that's really hurting the film business because nobody's manufacturing that film anymore. But it's less likely that anybody will now that there's a digital equivalent to it. And so it stays in the history books. But anybody that likes infrared photography, I've seen some really overdone, super color infrared that is just awful. If you're going to go infrared, I've always told people, 720 nanometer, the Hoya R72 filter is really nice because it'll be a pure infrared for contrast, but you've got just enough color information to play with false colors, create blue skies, and the bulk of my infrared work has been done with that. This is a new option that I'm going to seriously consider. I've got a couple of cameras that I have converted to full spectrum photography, which this would fit very nicely on and give me the spectrum of colors that I'm seeing in these images. So it's going to be on my to experiment with list come the springtime. I think I could have some fun with this.
So when are they talking about production?
I'm not sure. It doesn't state specifically on this article, but I'm going to follow up with Coleri Vision personally and see if there's an actual time and an availability date for it. So, but Shiv, I'm sure you looked through the whole image gallery here, and it's beautiful.
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it.
It doesn't feel overdone, and that's what I love about it. I don't know how much they've put into post. I hope very little, because that would make it all the more magical for me.
Now the question really comes up is, can this be replicated as a conversion? And will somebody like a LifePixel or somebody pick up on this and do an in-body conversion for this filter?
That could be very nice. I think Coleri Vision might also offer conversions of cameras as well.
I didn't see that.
I know that a guy that I've worked with before that I trust every bit of skill he has in converting cameras, Dan Llewellyn. He's based out of New Jersey, and his website is maxmax.com, M-A-X.com.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
He converted my, I've got an ultraviolet 5D Mark II, where he somehow, with whatever skill set he has, shaved off the color filter array off of the sensor itself. And in doing so, that made it 6 times more sensitive to ultraviolet light. Black and white, mind you, but it made it viable to shoot video at high ISOs in pure UV. And so if anybody would be interested in that, I'm sure Dan would. I just pulled it up on their website, by the way, Shiv. The pre-order estimated time of arrival is late March of 2019. So you would have it in time for spring. The cost, which if you were to be pre-ordering a 37 millimeter, then it's at $49.99. If you want to go all the way up to a 95 millimeter is 190. Probably the most common filter that I have in my set is 77
millimeters.
And they are at $134.99.
That's not bad. That's not bad.
Not bad at all for exploring a new area of photography. It's cheaper than any modern lens I own, anyhow.
So you're going to cost me some more money now.
I just might.
It never ends.
Again,
does it?
I can't say that I've used this, but it feels like it's something that I would love to tinker with. If I'm out for a day shooting infrared, I've got a filter pouch with every single filter size, wavelength rather, just to experiment with. And I almost always invariably go to the 720 nanometer, but something like this might rival it if I could find the right scenario, the right field.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, talking about spending money, it's a slight off subject over here. Right now, what I'm basically doing is, all right, I got my Leica R lenses. I'm looking for adapters to use my R lenses on the L mount.
They have them.
And they have them, yeah. Novaflex actually has one, which I just received today, so I'm thrilled. And then I have some old manual Nikon lenses, and I found an adapter to mount those onto the L mount. So
really? Does Novaflex make that adapter?
No, that's made by Kipon.
Okay.
Yeah. So, one of the first things when I get my hands on the S1 or the S1R is I want to run, some time lapses in full frame to see what those are going to be like. And you need manual lenses to do that. So I'm feeling pretty good that at least two adapters are now in.
I've got the Canon EF to L mount adapter, also made by Novaflex, and I was using it on an S1 camera to shoot snowflakes.
Yeah, but you indicated that you were having some problems with it, right?
Well, the only issue is that I was using pre-production firmware version 0.5.
Okay.
And they gave me the camera with the 24-105 lens, which I don't even think I mounted onto the camera body. Mm. But I think that's the only one that with that firmware version was properly talking to other things. So it's just an issue of me saying, okay, well, the camera's not exactly feature complete. So when I put on an adapter that they don't expect me to adapting to it, because that's going to be the spit and polish on firmware version 1.0, then yeah, I can expect to run into issues like that. So I just taped over the electrical contacts and used the lens.
Use it as
manual lenses. That's just, you know, the price of being on the bleeding edge and sort of testing out some prototypes.
So
I wouldn't say that's reflective of the finished product.
An expensive spacer.
Exactly. So, but, talking about being on the bleeding edge, I've done a lot of interesting things in my career. And as I mentioned, just photographing snowflakes, one of the very first times I had done that, I realized that I was onto something, using reflected light to photograph all of the wonderful surface details of a snowflake. And I thought, okay, I got something here. This was at the very beginning of my professional career as a photographer. And I thought, how can I monetize this? I mean, my background is marketing and advertising. And so that's very great skills to have as a professional photographer because you're effectively an entrepreneur and a small business person. Mm-hmm. So I sent it out to just about everybody in every possible way I could think of. Magazines, the post office, maybe they could put them on stamps. Just anywhere that it could possibly be useful. And I got an email back from the editor of one magazine, Outdoor Photography Canada magazine. And the editor, Roy Ramsey, told me, your images are great. I'd like to see an article written on spec. And we'll take a look at that, see if we can maybe be interested in publishing you. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I mean, I've got a green light here to at least move forward for consideration.
Yeah.
And I wrote that article. I rewrote it. I had some friends that had education in literature and language studies and things that were giving me pointers on, substitutional words or changing the grammatical structures of certain things. It had to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And the editor loved it and ran it as a feature story. And in fact, it was the cover shot for Outdoor Photography Canada episode or issue number 20 in the winter of 2012, which was it was huge for me. And I really got my foot in the door and I did a lot with them. The reason why I'm mentioning this is because just this week I had the somber honor.
But weren't you doing more than just writing articles? You were actually...
I was doing a lot for them. Yeah. But Outdoor Photography Canada is closing their doors. They have shut down. Their website will stay live until March 31st of this year, in case you wanted to peruse any of the articles and content that's there. And there are some full articles if you want to check out outdoorphotographycanada.com. After I wrote that article, I stayed in touch with the editor. And I had a background in web design from a former life. And so I said, you know what, your website's pretty archaic here. Let's try and, you know, bring you up a little bit. This was in 2013. Mm-hmm. So I did a website redesign. It was probably due for a new one now by 2019 because it's still looking a little bit dated at this point. But that's not going to come because they didn't have the funds to put out the issue over the winter, the November, December issue. And so that one, I mean, I wrote an article for it and maybe I'll publish that separately somewhere else, but I won't be paid for that because it was never published. And it's really sad to see a magazine like this go because they really helped me grow as a professional. When the opportunity came about to start writing a column for them, because I was actively involved in their website and everything else, and some of that work I was doing for free, you know, I was first in line to be handed a column. And I had the beginner basics column for a number of years until they gave me my own column called Pushing Limits, where, you know, I talked about all the geekiest, you know, techie stuff that I could about photography. It was a wonderful soapbox for me to have. So it's really tough to be in the print business. You know, the industry in general is shrinking and consolidating. And, you know, Popular Photography recently closed down. Yep. Shutterbug magazine is now digital only. American Photo also closed down recently around the same time as Popular Photography. And that's not all of them. I mean, you could go back in time further, and they've been closing down. In fact, a friend of mine who was also a guest host on This Week in Photo, Tristan Hall, had a magazine for about 5 years or so called Photo Comment out of South Africa. And he had to close the doors on that one in 2014. So, what's your feeling about where the print industry is going and how photographers can still get a leg up getting their work published?
Well, unfortunately, it's the cost, you know, and there's no way to overcome print costs. I mean, those will continue to actually rise. They're not going to in any way come down. It's the cost of paper. It's the cost of printing. And then it's the cost of subscriptions. So when you have an alternative, which is internet-based, like digital magazines, digital subscriptions, and things of that sort, can be done much cheaper. It's unfortunate, but that's exactly what's going on. You go back to photography, and back in the days, holding a print was the most exciting thing you could do.
Oh, yeah.
And now to get somebody to print something, it's like, do I have to? You know, I mean,
I'm a firm believer that the print isn't finished until it's like the photo isn't finished until it's printed.
Completely
so most
agree.
Images never really get quote unquote finished. They're always in a state of getting there. Mm-hmm. And many of mine don't get printed. I mean, you know, you produce so much content, you're not going to have enough wall space to put it all out there. But you're right, the costs constantly go up. And subscribership would be going down in most cases. Now, Roy Ramsey, the editor, he ran a tight ship. I mean, he was the only primary staff member and the owner of Sunlight Media, which published the magazine. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, we were all contributors and we were paid well for our contributions on a monthly basis. And then feature articles were paid not only for the images based on their size, but you were paid per word as well, quite nicely. And, you know, higher rates, of course, for cover shots and double page bleeds and what have you. They had the whole pricing structure set out there. So we were well afforded for that. But there was not a whole lot of overhead. There was one other person that was sending out the newsletter, and I was communicating with them through the website to get all the newsletter contacts and what have you. But that was it. there was no secretary. There was no levels of management, and so because of that, they were able to continue on for as long as they did. And now, if you want to publish your work, where are you going to go? There are still magazines out there that will pay for your content. A lot of them won't. A lot of them will ask you to use it for free. Mm-hmm. Get a lot of people asking me for that. And I generally just say no. But if you're looking for photographic education, there's a lot of it for free. Yeah. I learned everything that I know by watching videos and reading mm-hmm. free articles on digital photography school, and just browsing through the photo blogs like F-Stoppers, which have a lot of educational content as well, Petapixel and others. Mm-hmm. So if I can learn everything that I've learned pretty much for free, aside from a few workshops that I've taken with professionals that I really wanted to learn from personally, it kind of makes it scary for anybody that's in the publishing business right now. If your competition has so much more content than you and costs people nothing to a worldwide audience.
Absolutely. And the fact remains that, you look at the internet today, Google a topic. Is this not one article? There's 20, 30 articles about it. I think that to your point where, personal one-on-one type education that magazines never provided. It's really you still went back to the individual who was the expert in that particular topic or subject. And you said, can I do a workshop with you? Or can I do a one-on-one training session with you? And that's how it, sort of education evolves. And then you go write an article about it. So now everybody else knows how to do it. It's a madhouse out there. You look at YouTube.
You look at some of the stuff that I've been talking about, some weird stuff like ultraviolet fluorescence mm-hmm. photography, which is an unusual niche, but you tell people exactly what equipment to buy and how to get into it. And I know a lot of people that, based on my influence, are now shooting wonderful images of glowing flowers that they never thought were possible.
And then they put it on YouTube and show you how to do it. So now it's done,
Exactly, exactly.
And that's where the difference comes up from, paper content, as I call it. Where you don't have a video experience or an actual how-to experience. I can write two paragraphs on how to focus on something, but I can show it very quickly.
Yeah.
And our attention span as human beings continues to diminish.
Isn't that the truth?
So as that's happening, we're looking for and we're seeking for quick fixes and a quick high. I want to know how to do this. Boom. All right.
Yet we're 52 minutes into this podcast and there are people still listening to us. So there's two sides of that coin. People on long commutes are just sitting there down folding laundry, doing an editing marathon, whatever you're doing when you're listening to this podcast at this length. Thank you for holding on.
Well, that's a very good thing.
It is. And our listenership continues to grow. I'm very happy with that. And if anybody is listening that likes the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you subscribe to this, because that helps more people discover this content, which is free. I'm not charging anybody for it, not even taking ads at this point. But we do like to recommend some products, services, apps, gear, whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm. At the end of the episode, the picks of the week, I like to call it. So, Shiv, I know you've got two. Start with one, then I'll do mine, and you can finish off.
Well, let me do the more expensive one first.
Sure.
And photographers are always passionate about good glass, and good glass makes good images, and good images makes good money. I mean, it's just a sequence of events. So, my pick of the week for this week's episode is the Panasonic Lumix Leica 50-200, which on a Micro Four Thirds system equates to a 100-400mm lens, which may not be the ideal lens for every photographer, but
I had one of those lenses for a long time. It's what I did a lot of my telephoto work for on mm-hmm. a full-frame camera.
But people who are into nature, wildlife, and that kind, that was pretty much the go-to focal length system, 100-400. And there was always, you know, this desire to, can I actually put a times, you know, 1.4 adapter on it? And I don't think anybody really made a good 1.4 or even a 2.0 adapter for the 100-400.
Yeah, well, at least the first one that I had, the Canon 100-400, aka the dust pump.
Oh, the piston.
Yes, it. I tried using a 2x teleconverter on that lens, and the results were worse than if I just cropped in 50% on the image without it. Yeah. It's like, okay, well, that's not worth it for me. Let's just sell that off.
Right. So with the 5200, it is adaptable to teleconverters, and incredibly well adapted. So
I should say, but before I continue, that was the very first edition of the teleconverter. I'm now remembering that I had a friend
version
of mine,
2, version 3.
I think they're up to version 3 now, and it behaved much, much better with those earlier lenses.
Yeah, but it's still not there. I mean, the 1.4, I believe, is still acceptable, but the 2 is not. Now, I've shot with the 5200 using both the 1.4 and the x2 teleconverters, and the performance is exceptional. There's no degradation in the speed of focusing. There's no real significant degradation of the quality of the image, except with the 2, maybe a little bit on the edges. But, you know, for nature and wildlife, the edges are not that important.
And it's a small lens compared
to
what the equivalent on a full frame would have been.
See, it's, not even 7 inches.
Yeah.
So it's an exceptionally good product. So that's my expensive pick of the week.
Well, and when you say expensive, how do you know what the cost is off the top of your head?
No, Don, can you bring it up on the web? I mean, the B&H site.
I can easily do that. I can say, I got B&H up right here because, well, of course I do. I spend way too much money there. The Panasonic Leica is, 50-200 is $1,697.99. So,
yeah.
And from B&H, anyhow, it's got 5-star reviews. So your admiration for this is echoed by others.
Yeah, it's absolutely a phenomenal lens. And what I really like about it is that the balance, you know, on my G9, it is so beautifully balanced. One of the things that I always had a problem with when I was shooting Canon back, 2013 is when I switched over to mirrorless. I found the 100-400 to be front heavy, way too front heavy. And even with the foot, it just didn't feel comfortable. And if you had to use the push pull, it just made it even worse. You know, from a comfort level, this is absolutely an ideal product.
All right. Well, we'll put that. We'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, where people can check that out. It's one of the lenses that I haven't used, so I was very curious to know what your opinion is. I've used the 100-400, the Leica 100-400, and that was wonderful. But the equivalent of 800 millimeters reach is more than some people might need. It depends on the kind of work that you do.
Yeah.
And you know, to each their own. They cover a different range and a different purpose.
Right.
Right. So, speaking of a different range, my pick is something from Venus Optics. They've been making some interesting manual lenses for a while, and they produced one that nobody else has really made before. And so the Laowa 15mm macro lens is my pick. I got it when I was shooting Micro Four Thirds, and I could adapt it to that, but with the focal length increase, it doesn't have its true shine. So I put it on the S1 when I was testing it for a little while. And the proportional differences when you have a wide angle, and you can go all the way to 1-to-1 macro magnification with this. It is a true macro lens.
How close does it focus?
What does it say here? It says in meters, 0.12 meters. So it's 12 centimeters. That's you know, fairly close. And to that point, I can make like a large mushroom and some grass.
12 millimeters. No, something is odd. Because normally minimum focus is from the sensor to the subject.
No. That's from the objective element to the subject. That's working distance in terms of macro. So with this, and I could reduce that even further if I wanted to get like right underneath something.
Put some tubes,
extension tube on it. I haven't tried that yet, but I've been able to do that successfully with a fisheye lens. So I'm sure it can accept at least a modest extension tube. Maybe not.
So they have another macro, which is that strange looking.
The probe lens, which I have as well, the 24mm probe lens, and it's in a case just sitting behind me here. I've got a lot of fun ideas to explore that with that I haven't had a chance with. And same thing for this 15mm lens here. I put it on the camera and I did some studio tests. Nothing that I would write home about in terms of like an image to share, but it got the ideas spinning inside my head.
Right.
I was just about to mention like a mushroom surrounded by grass will look like the underbrush in a forest and the mushrooms being the trees.
Yes.
I mean, the sense of scale when you go wide angle on a macro.
Oh, it's
like
huge.
That,
huge.
It's huge. So we have amazing award-winning perennial gardens in our backyard that take a lot of effort to maintain. But once in a while, when I don't have the garden gloves on and I go out and I just start photographing the flowers and everything else to get a further more unique perspective with this 15mm lens, I'm sure I'm going to spend days in the garden with it. And I mean, it's a manual lens, so manual aperture, manual focus. There's nothing electronic about it. But I handle a lot of that stuff manually on macro scales anyhow. So that's no deterrent.
They have another 15mm lens that they call the 0D.
Yes, zero distortion. That's what the D stands for. And that's much more expensive. That's $850,
I believe. But it's a beautiful lens.
It is. And they are making some very high quality glass. They've got that 15mm in the Sony mount, I know for sure, but I'm sure it's in other mounts. I just don't have them in front of me right here. The 15mm f4 macro is $499 US.
Not bad.
So
not bad.
It's not bad. I mean, most of the gear I shoot with is more expensive than that, and the build quality seems really rock solid. It even has a shift mechanism on it too. So if I look at the back of the lens, it has kind of like a panoramic window to it. It's kind of hard to see.
But yes, I do.
I can shift the mount side to side. So it doesn't have a tilt mechanism like a full tilt shift lens does, but it gives you a little bit more creative potential.
No, but for macro, if you are going to do panoramic macros or stitched macros, then you don't need a tilt. All you need is a shift, and that's perfect.
So that's my pick. Again, I've only had some studio testing hands-on. The real fun will come in April and May when the flowers start to bloom. So I'll
when you can go out and not freeze.
Exactly. Shiv, you had something else you wanted to mention.
I'm sort of working on doing more and more getting into video and video for nature wildlife again. That's primarily what I want to do. And I picked up this lavalier microphone from a company called Saramonic. They're pretty new in the industry. And then I was introduced to the Saramonic wireless system, which I'll just show it to you here if you can see that.
Yeah. And I brought up a picture, and the link will be in the show notes too.
And so they are exceptionally good. I mean, the range is excellent. The quality of the audio that comes out is really brilliant. And the fact is that they give you all the adapters, all the way from XLR adapters to your standard, microphone jacks. And it comes with one lavalier mic. But the receiver is actually dual channel, so you can put more than one system to it.
Oh, that's amazing. I would have so bought this over the Rode. I've got a very similar system from Rode. I forget the exact model name on it, which is more expensive too. This is only $269 from what I'm seeing on their website.
Yeah. So for $269, you have a system that can not only do all this wireless stuff, which is great, but let's say you're doing an interview with multiple people, a small mixer, and they have some very interesting mixers. I haven't bought the mixers yet, but you can actually take a mixer and put it on a table and not have to worry about running wires all the way back to your camera or to your recording device. Use the wireless because the bandwidth on this is exceptionally good. So there's lots of little nuances. That
how long does the battery life last on this thing?
Forever. It uses 9-volt batteries.
Oh, so it's
So it's really nice. I mean, it's got a little case. Sorry, not 9-volt. It uses 2 AA batteries.
Okay.
There's another system that I was using before that has that, but they come in a cartridge. So, you know, replacing this is a real quick thing because you can just pop one in and pop one out.
And you're off to the races. And I'm sure that they'd sell extra magazines for a couple of dollars. It's just some plastic and some metal there. But I'm looking this up, and yeah, they've got all the adapters. You've got that XLR adapter right in there. So. This is incredibly versatile as a kit for the price, anyhow. And I'm glad to see somebody like you, Shiv, is using it and is hands-on with it. Because if you did not give your stamp of approval on this, there would be a red flag on the price. Because how many corners would you have to cut to get it
to make it $250-odd worth? Right.
Exactly. Yeah, but if you're saying if they're an upstart, an up-and-comer, they've got to make a wave. Yeah. I mean, when they started with their mirrorless cameras, they priced them so competitively, they gained market share immediately.
Yeah, it's a hefty, well-built, I would say, tank-like device.
All right. The Saramonic, it's kind of a cryptic name, the UW Mic 9 RX 9 Plus TX 9 UHF wireless lavalier mic system with dual channel receiver for DSLRs, mirrorless cameras, and video cameras. Yes. You don't have to remember all of that. You just got to go to photogeekweekly.com, where I will have the link to that.
Click on the link and you're there.
Speaking of where you can find our show notes, where can people find you on the internet, Shiv, if they want to connect with you and ask you questions?
My first name, last name, just remember it's not a W in the middle, it's 2 V's. So it's shivverma.com, and everything that I do is linked from there.
Perfect. All your social media and all of your happenings, everybody can find you there. I can see you are a member of the Photographic Society of America, as you mentioned, the New England Camera Club Council, and if you've got his email address and every other way to get in touch with him, including some workshops. So you want to touch on that real quickly before we finish?
Yeah. 2019, if you still want to come, I have 2 spaces left on the Vietnam photo tour. It's not a workshop. It's a photo tour. That's in March. Then I have a big one in Alaska for the bears, where we will have our own private planes and boats. Tanzania, which is pretty exclusive. My idea of doing a wildlife safari is 1 person per row. There's no 2 people sitting side by side, so you have a full row to yourself, left and right of each vehicle. So there's Tanzania, then there's Iceland. Let's see. Those are the main ones. There are some smaller workshops in Cape Cod and the Finger Lakes in New York, but those are more, you know, foliage-related for the Finger Lakes and spring-related in Cape Cod. But the other big travel workshops are, Africa, Vietnam, Iceland. And then I'm working on next year's programs to Namibia, China, Botswana, and India.
Wow, that's extensive. I mean, I'm going to Iceland this year as well in October when all the tourists are gone and the nights are longer for beautiful aurora stuff. And of course, you can find information on that at doncom.ca. But Shiv, those workshop lineups, if anybody wants to learn from a pro like you, who you're really down to earth and easy to work with, easy to understand, and if you're in one of these more exotic locations, whether it's a photo tour or a workshop, I'm sure you're willing to give people the insight and knowledge to help them get the shot along the way.
Oh, absolutely. And it's really based upon, whether you're a beginner or you're seasoned, there's always something to learn. But what I really encourage is, people who are seasoned, to work with some of the other photographers and give them your kind of experience and your knowledge, because we all learn from each other. And to me, the most important thing is the ability to share.
Sometimes I even learn from questions that people ask me about my own work, because I didn't think of it in that particular way.
Absolutely, yes.
And one of the great ways that I learn, actually, is by critiquing other people's images. So when I've got some students and I'm sitting down, especially when we're doing a one-to-one private workshop, which I do as well, and I can sit down and we can dissect a photograph. And to them, it's incredibly valuable. But to me, the exercise of doing that, I mean, it isn't, if you stop doing it, you don't stay good at it, right? Mm-hmm. But the more you do it, the better at it you are, and the better you are at judging your own work, which you're always the worst at. Mm-hmm. So anybody out there listening to this has a great tip. Whether you're on a photo workshop with other photographers or you're just browsing through your Facebook page, just make mental critiques of things, even if you keep it to yourself. It's one of the greatest ways to give you photographic mental exercises moving forward.
Yep. Good advice. Very good advice.
All right. Well, on that note, I think we're finished with this particular episode. Thank you, Shiv, so much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Don. It was a pleasure.
The pleasure's all mine. And for everybody listening, it's time to get out and shoot.